Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I have been listening on the train to This Woman's Work by Kate Bush. And we have already referenced that song recently with Maxwell, the singer, because he obviously did a cover of it.
Yep.
But I actually felt like listening to that album today, Sensual World, on the way up here, because it's one of my favourite ever albums. But it obviously come into my mind because I've been researching today's guest, whose incredible paintings really do focus on women's work, in a sense. And also a friend of mine, Ferran Gibson, has just written a book called Women's Work as well. And it's kind of been a theme in my week. And we are massive fans of today's guest. She's an extraordinary painter and has a show coming up at Stephen Friedman Gallery. And there's something so wonderful about these works because they're so intimate and personal, and it's kind of everyday experience and kind of moments that you might kind of overlook or forget or not think are important, but are actually the foundation of kind of all of our lives. And those very personal family moments, the intimacy between a mother, a child, a kind of experience of a woman in the world, you know, going to work. And it's a very specific experience. And I feel like these paintings are following on from a really rich history, but also taking them to a new place. So I'm very excited to welcome to Talk Art, Caroline Walker. Hi, Caroline.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Have we torn you away from your studio to have you here today?
Not really, no. You know, I like to have at least one day off a week.
So, Saturday's your day off?
One of the weekend days, usually, yeah.
So you're from Scotland, as we can hear.
Yes, Dunfermline.
Dunfermline. Yeah. Is that quite high up?
Not really, no. It's in the central belt. It's in Fife. So my nearest big city was Edinburgh.
Right. Oh, that's quite a cultured city then.
Yeah, lots to see. There's lots of art to see.
Did you see that as a kid?
Yeah. That was really, you know, the first paintings I was seeing were things in the National Gallery in Edinburgh, or there was a museum near where I grew up in a town called Kirkcaldy that had a lot of, particularly a lot of Scottish colourist paintings in its collection. So that was the kind of stuff I was first exposed to.
That's where we met. We met in Edinburgh.
Yeah, Russ and
really?
I met there. Yeah.
At the National Gallery.
Yeah, at the National Galleries of Scotland, yeah, for Tracy Emin's solo show. But also, this podcast only exists because of our mums. That was the other thing I was thinking about in relation to the new body of work you've been making for your show in London based on motherhood. I was thinking it's really interesting.
Well, no, that's based on the sister-in-law.
Oh, sorry.
New body of work, but there has been a series based on your mother.
No, but the sister-in-law's had a baby. So it's her mother.
Oh, I see. Yes,
she's the mother, Russ.
Yes.
So it is still motherhood.
Yes.
Anyway, and I was thinking how funny it is that the podcast itself is influenced by our mums, and then we're now talking about motherhood. I love it.
Did your mums encourage you to start it?
Yeah.
We did a podcast together, and they said we've learnt more about why you're obsessed with art from this 1 hour of you chatting the podcast than we ever have talking about you in real life. So That's how we started it.
Yeah,
it's
really cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you're based in London now then?
Yes, I've been here for 15 years.
Right.
Yeah, so quite a long time. Although I'm actually moving back up to Scotland.
Are you?
Yeah.
And where will you be living?
Really close to where I grew up, just outside that town.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah. My husband and I have bought a derelict farm that we're turning into a house and studio.
That's so exciting.
So it's going to be a bit of a change of scene from living in London for quite a long time.
So how long have you been in London?
15 years.
Oh, okay, wow. And what was it, the pandemic or, you know, what, or is it just time in your life that you
I thought I'd always want to move back up eventually. I had my first baby 2.25 years ago. And I think we just sort of, once we had a baby and we're a bit more kind of, we couldn't enjoy London as much as we used to. You know, we don't go out so much now in the evenings and stuff. And we live in quite a small flat. And we just sort of thought, oh, we could have all this space and sort of expand up in Scotland and have a slightly different life. But also still, you know, I feel like I've established enough now in what I'm doing that I can come down to London without actually having to be here all the time.
Yes, definitely.
So you felt like before as an artist you had to be in London to make an impact?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, I remember, this must be like 15 or 16 years ago when I was thinking about going to do an MA and one of my old tutors from Glasgow School of Art, I was asking her advice about where to do an MA, and she said to me, if you want to have a career in London, you're going to have to study there. And I think she was right. And it was, you know, obviously that's what I did. I came down to study at the Royal College, which is what brought me here. And I think having that base then allowed me to be able to start establishing connections and things here.
Do you think that's still the case now with social media and everything?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I'd be interested to know what artists of this slightly younger generation that are coming out of these courses now. It's probably very different. When I graduated from the Royal College in 2009, there wasn't really social media. There was Facebook, but that wasn't something that was used in our art kind of context, Instagram or something like that. And you kind of made all of your connections really by actually physically meeting people, by going to openings and things like that. And I'm sure that's still a really important part of things, but I think there is also that that platform of Instagram that just makes everything so much more accessible to so many more people, doesn't it?
I've really noticed as well, artists, some of the younger artists that I've been meeting, even like an artist in America called Bianca Fields, like she's living in Kansas City, and then there's a whole group of artists now living in St. Louis, and they're not necessarily living in New York anymore because the rents are so expensive. And I think the same thing's happened here. And I really like this idea of like decentralizing it all and like moving to other towns and finding space both psychologically but also physically for the studio.
Yeah.
And then being somewhere that you can in a few hours be in the city, come and put on shows here, but you don't necessarily have to be here the whole time. I think it's a really healthy thing and really exciting, really.
Yeah, well, it means that there's things going on in other cities as well. Like Louise Giovanelli, who obviously she's in Manchester. Like that's no barrier to her being very visible as an artist, just because she's not in London. So.
And it actually widens everyone's experience, doesn't it? For the whole art world, for different communities, like it's actually a good thing to have choice and to be able to get on the train and go to see shows or in different places. Like it's rich, really, isn't it, for our cultural life?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your work. Rob was saying in the intro about your practice, but something about it is that you make the ordinary remarkable. It's like you make us notice the everyday. And people coming to your work will see these portraits of women, many singular, but it's very voyeuristic. So it's set back and you're capturing these women at work, like Rob was saying, women's work. How did you come across that subject as something that you wanted to celebrate, I would guess?
Well, I guess I've always wanted to paint and draw women. Like really, since I was a little girl, that was all I wanted to draw. I used to sit in this cupboard in the kitchen and just scribble away sort of for hours and away into these little drawings of what I refer to as fancy ladies. They were either, there was only two types of women in this sort of childhood world of mine.
Yeah.
They were either very glamorous, women, these were the fancy ladies with glamorous dresses and high heels on, or they were quite thinly veiled depictions of my mum doing housework. So I guess I was sort of hardwired, I think, from the beginning to be really interested in looking at women and looking at images of them and making pictures about them. And that's something that I suppose I've just never really lost as a, you know, as developed my work as an artist. But I think that in itself has kind of changed in different ways over the years. I spent a long time working in quite a constructed way where I was hiring locations, hiring models, clothing them, directing them into this sort of narrative of my own design. And that sustained me for a number of years. But then I suppose I kind of ran out of steam with that, and at the same time started noticing things much more in my life around me in London. I just started seeing all of these nail bars out of the window of the bus on my way going to and from the studio, and became quite fascinated by them as spaces about who was in there. Like, it's such a female dominated space, nearly all women working there, and nearly always women clientele. And I suppose that was the first women at work paintings I was making. So that was in 2016. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of went back to doing a little bit of more of this very constructed sort of stuff. But the real change for me came in 2017. I did a project for Kettle's Yard, which was a kind of commission.
That was their reopening?
Yeah, for that first show of them reopening. And they asked me to make some work in response to the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. And obviously that was like, it's a huge subject to think about. And it took me that was in 2016 they approached me about that. It took me a long time thinking about it to decide if it was the right thing for me to do as an artist, and if so, how I would sort of tackle that.
Why would that be? Because I read you say that you feel like an artist has responsibility. Do you feel a responsibility for the images that you put out in the world?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's sort of it's having to think about whether it's appropriate for me to tell somebody else's story who's in a situation that's very different to mine. Mm. And about how that can be done in a sensitive way that makes those people still feel that they have ownership and authorship over that, the way that that's told. Mm-hmm. And it was seen at the time, it seemed quite very different to the work that I was making. So it also had to feel right for me as an artist that it was the right kind of subject for me to address. And I made the decision that if it was going to be something that I could respond to, it had to be about women, because that was always what my work was about. Mm. And that it should be about women in London, because it was a city that I was living in. So I found a charity called Women for Refugee Women that's actually run, that's based very close to my studio. And I got in touch with them, and they were quite receptive to the idea of doing something with me. And in the end, that took the form of this collaboration with them, where I made a series of portraits of five of the women in their network in the accommodation that they were in at that time, which was summer 2017. And that was such a kind of, it was a bit of a kind of a light bulb moment for me, really, because it was, I suddenly realised that I'd been spending all these years like inventing all these stories, but actually like real people's lives are far more powerful, and that actually the stories are there, and these people around us, and these people's lives who are quite invisible in this city. And it made me really start thinking about that idea of invisibility and what we value in society, in both in terms of monetary value, which is how I sort of got into that idea of thinking about women at work. So directly after that body of work, with this idea of invisibility, and then also still thinking about that work that I'd made with the nail bars, I started thinking about the idea of that in this work context, and I made a series of paintings of women working as housekeeping staff in hotels, mm-hmm. Because that is a job that seems to be 99% women, as far as I can see. And of course, it's a job that, by its very nature, is designed to be invisible. It was that sort of moment that really started this, and then it's just a subject that I feel like it's so broad that I've got so many different ways to go with it.
Mm. How do you approach these subjects then? So like the women in nail bar, and I guess it's an interesting concept of some workers are designed to be invisible. Like you said, the people in the hotel, people that stay in the hotel don't want to really see the room service staff, do they? But how do you approach them, and how do they respond to you? And what is your process? Do you photograph them or sketch them?
Yeah, so... with most of these things, most of the projects that I've done, it involves spending time shadowing women while they're working and photographing them.
All right.
How I get that access to that is quite varied. With the nail bars, I went round lots of nail bars, which is really embarrassing, with my sort of iPad. Going, look, this is my work. You know, like, can I? I'd really like to do something with you. And I don't know how many I went into before I got some that would actually work with me, but I did in the end. And then with the hotels, that took about 6 months till I found any hotels that would even respond to me. And actually, in both of those cases, with the nail bar and the hotels that I work with, the owners of them had an interest in art, so that was kind of what gave me the in. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
But you would turn up and you would photograph them with your iPad.
Oh, sorry, no. I mean, I was just showing pictures on my iPad to try and sort of get them interest.
Yeah, the pitch.
Yeah, the pitch. Yeah.
What is the process after they go, yeah, that's fine, let's do it?
For example, with the housekeeping stuff, I had an arrangement with the head housekeeper, and I went to one big hotel where I sort of turned up at 8:30 in the morning for their morning meeting. Which was all conducted in Romanian, so I didn't understand what anybody was saying, but they were talking about me because they were sort of laughing at me.
Oh, no.
And I was standing in the corner taking photos.
No.
And then I got given a sort of key to all floors, and they were like, if the door's open and somebody's working in the room, you know, you can photograph them, like everybody has agreed.
Wow.
So with something like that, it was quite... I was sort of floating around a bit, and there was a bit of a language barrier. Most of the women didn't have very good English, so wasn't really a chance to sort of chat with them much. But then I worked at another hotel where I just spent one morning with the same housekeeper all morning, and that was really nice. Got a chance to find out a bit more about her life and, how she'd sort of come to do this job and things. So it's a bit of a mix, really. It depends what's available to me, I suppose. And the thing with trying to document people while they're working is they're often very busy. So I'm kind of trying to be invisible myself in the background.
Is that the voyeuristic approach that we see in your work then? Because you are taking a step back. You aren't imposing yourself within their scene. You're the viewer, and we are the viewer of your view.
Yeah, I think I always want the work to still acknowledge the fact that I'm an outsider. I'm always kind of looking into somebody else's life or somebody else's work, or and I'm getting a momentary glimpse of that. So I think some of the way that actually manifests itself in the paintings is practical. You know, I am standing at a distance to be able to get as much of a room in, or to not get in somebody's way. But I always keep that in, keep the corner of the door or the thing that I've been sort of looking round.
But there's a cup of tea sometimes to signify you, like the artist is present.
Yeah, there's often the objects of my... Or sometimes I'm caught in a reflection of a mirror or something like that, slightly creepy spectre in the background of the camera.
Are they interested in the final product? You know, they must be curious about what you're going to make of them. Did they get to see these
works? Yeah, Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's funny. I just did this really big project at the at UCLH in the maternity ward, and that was quite. I spent several days there in different parts and met, you know, 30 or 40 different people doing things, and I made these paintings. And some, it's always interesting the difference in response. Some people are really excited about it and really want to see the work and talk about it. And other people, they don't really engage at all in it. But they're happy to let, they're happy to be in it, but they don't really want to sort of talk about it much afterwards. Yeah, yeah. So
interesting.
Maybe they just don't know how to talk about it. Some people are kind of alienated by art and they don't have the language, so they'd rather not ask anyone anything. Like you've had experiences where you've been at dinners and they've said, "What do you do?" And you go, "I'm a gallerist," and they sort of go,
"They literally turn the other way and then talk to the other guests. Turn their back on me for the whole wedding. It's really strange." Yeah, and I'm less sat on my own. Like, it's really, sometimes people get quite a visceral reaction to like being scared of having to talk about art. But I can also imagine if you've been the subject of a painting, maybe that's embarrassing or something. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I don't know. When I was doing the housekeeping project in the big hotel, there was one woman who's actually featured in quite a few paintings, and her English was pretty good, and I spent quite a while with her and we were chatting a bit, and she seemed very bemused by what I was up to. Like, she didn't really like, she was like "You're gonna make paintings of these?" And she said, "Why would anybody want to see a painting of us to see if we're good at cleaning?" And I was like, no. Like, I was trying to sort of explain to her that, like, why shouldn't anybody want to see a painting of you? Like, trying to sort of make her think about that she's just as worthy of being the subject of a work of art as anybody else. So, yeah, I think it's sort of maybe yeah, I think it's maybe a bit of a weird thing for people to get their head around, like, what is this about, well, kind of thing.
If they've also been deemed invisible and suddenly you're giving them that much attention, then it must be confusing to them, like you're saying, like, "Are you snooping on me?" sort of thing, checking out that the work is actually all right. I mean, what I'm always drawn to with your work is that I think as an actor as well, and a writer, there's an interiority. You can really read the inner monologue of your characters, especially one that I love, Elaine, which is, you're from your local favourite bakery, and she's there, and this was during the pandemic, and she's looking at you, she's got like a kind of the white bakery trilby hat and a mask on. I just know who she is. I can hear her voice in my head, I can imagine her demeanour, how she's serving everyone. You're giving absolute agency to, you know, the peripheral, the people we take for granted, I guess, but you're elevating them to art. You know, you're making sure that people know they exist. And that's a gift. Do you feel that? And I guess that's where you feel this responsibility.
Yeah, I suppose it's, why that person? Why not somebody else? I mean, for me, Elaine was an obvious choice. That painting of her was made for a show at a South Bank Centre called Everyday Heroes. And I got asked to do a painting for that. And like literally the day before or something, I got asked to do this thing. I'd been chatting to Elaine, and this was like right in the middle of the first lockdown.
And the bakery had stayed open.
Yeah, it was still open. And she was telling me how she was sort of really worried about coming to work every day. And she like said, "Oh, you know, my husband drives me up to work at 6. And he comes and picks me up at the end of it. And I get home, so I wash all the clothes that I was wearing, I have a shower, and then I stay in the house until the next day." And I was just sort of quite taken aback at that sacrifice of her own personal sort of enjoyment of her. You know, a lot of people spent lockdown going for nice walks and doing things, and she basically used all of her outside time to come and do this job. And I just thought she was, like, it really struck me as a very, like, the kindness and the sort of community kind of...
Community generosity.
Yeah, like, yeah, of people
of
like that.
That role in the community.
Yeah.
I actually really loved that project as well at South Bank Centre, because they asked other artists, like Benjamin Senior did an amazing one of a masked man in a
fruit market
store. Yeah. That was in Russell's group show in Margate recently. Barbara Walker. There were so many great artists that we know and love. But I loved the fact that they were also putting them on these big banners outside, and then the public could then go and see these moments that weren't very everyday.
Yeah, it was an outside exhibition.
Yeah, it was really funny. I felt like a celebrity at the baker's for a couple of months, because every time I went round, Elaine would be like, oh, all the, you know, like, they basically, the police is really busy at about 6:30 in the morning with tradesmen picking up their sandwiches and stuff for the day. And then a lot of them were driving off across Waterloo Bridge to go and do jobs and things. They'd be like, look, there's a lane, like on the side of the highway.
Did you get free buns and bread? And
I didn't get that many freebies, actually.
Oh, what? That's not on.
My daughter does very well in free gingerbread men, though, so I guess.
You know, I've been thinking a lot recently about authenticity and about the reason that a lot of us connect to artworks. And sometimes I see artists as they're evolving, you know, from when they graduate, and they've been looking at a lot of previous influences, whether it's historical or contemporary artists, and then you see their work and it's often kind of a riff on all those influences. And that shift between that point to then almost like finding like a voice, like your own voice, which in a way is within all of us from the beginning, but it's about struggling through society, then finding who you are. And one of the reasons I love your paintings is when I see them, I just believe them. Like, they're real, they are authentic, and they're genuine. And I think that is based on these collaborations you have with the sitter, and whether it be your mother, Janet, or whether it be, like, you know, Lisa, your sister-in-law, but, like, these very intimate connections, even the baker, it's someone you actually see or care about. Is that idea of that kind of bond between you and the sitter something that's, like, vital in order for you to find your own voice? Does that make sense?
I think it's... well, I suppose a lot of what I've done is veered between either the very personal, like my mum and my sister-in-law, and then these totally anonymous paintings where it's quite voyeuristic and it's a painting of a woman that I've never met and I never will meet, you know, somebody glimpsed through a window.
But they're always aware that they're being...
Not always.
Oh, right.
No, I've done some work that was specifically about what you see from the public space of the city as you walk around pavements, catching glimpses of other people's lives, I suppose, through the windows of shops or offices and things like that. So the work's often gone between those two things, although it was mainly pretty anonymous up until I made the paintings of my mum, actually. And I was, it seems, it's funny, I was talking about this with my husband recently. And he was sort of saying, oh, that was quite a risky move for you doing these paintings of your mum. And they don't, you know, they look like the least risky paintings you could possibly imagine. But I suppose, like, what he meant was that for me to do something that was quite personal, when I always felt for a number of years that I had to have this kind of quite objective distance from my subjects in order to be able to see them properly. It was when I was making those hotel housekeeping paintings and I was speaking to my mum about it that I suddenly realised that she was doing that invisible kind of work in the home as millions of other women do for no money, you know, and that suddenly there was actually, I'd been going in the same way that I'd had that epiphany about, oh, I've been going all over the world to make up all these stories. Suddenly thought, oh, I've also been looking always to women that I are outside of my own world for subjects, when actually there's some really interesting ones in the relationships that I have myself. Right. Yeah.
Was your mum aware that you were drawing her when you were a kid?
Oh, yes.
Was she ever upset that she was never the glamorous woman? She was always the...
I wrote this story when I was about 5 or something called Never Be a Washerwoman. And it's basically a stuff like...
About your mum?
She said, I just made so many drawings that she didn't keep them. She just had to chuck them away. But I used to make all these bookmarks for her. And there's this bookmark that she's got that she's kept, which is a little sort of series of scenes. And it's this woman who looks like my mum, I mean, as a 5-year-old drawer, in a kitchen sort of, and with a man sitting at the table going, where's my dinner? And she's like, you're just going to have to wait for it, sort of thing. And then eventually she says, you know, shut up or you'll be wearing it. So she said I had very strong ideas about
patriarchy and
yes. I was not, you know, not impressed. Like, why, you know, why does mummy have to do that and daddy does this sort of thing? So,
but amazing that as a kid, it's like a lot of artists, the work that they are drawn to as a kid remains their practice.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about little scenes. What we're seeing, they feel like movie stills, don't they? They're kind of, they're captured like stills from a movie. And then the woman's work, and you've got your mother in there, and this is Janet, and then you've done this whole series you've gone back to. But what I found fascinating about it is that you said that this could be, it's contemporary, it's now, but it could be 30 years ago, because what she's doing every day in the house, the housework, the making the beds, the hoovering, she's been doing that for 30 years.
Yeah.
So it has a timelessness in there.
Yeah, I think it's that idea of these repeated tasks, you know, the old saying, a woman's work is never done, yeah, kind of thing. It's like that work of maintenance labour, you know, of cleaning and cooking and caring and things like that is never complete. It's just sort of cyclical. It keeps going round and round, whether that's, you know, jobs that get done every day or every week or every year. And yeah, I wanted there to be this sort of sense of that cyclical nature of that in that body of work, this repetition, and for it to, yeah, feel a bit timeless in a way, but then also have, hopefully have these things in it that would make us recognise it as now, like, even if that's in just like the glimpse of a sort of, I don't know, a product sitting on the shelf or something that is a reminder of contemporary life.
Mm-hmm. What does Janet think of the body of work?
I wouldn't say she was reluctant to begin with, but she was a bit like, what the hell do you want to paint me for? Nobody's going to want them. But I think she did, she really liked them as a record of this, of that house, because this house has been her and my dad's kind of life's work in a way. Kind of caring for it, and that's the way she talks about it as well. And I think for her to see that in these paintings gives her a lot of pride, even if she feels a bit sort of embarrassed about seeing herself in the paintings.
Mm. Is that, I guess we interviewed another artist called Jenna Gribben, which I know that you listen to, and her partner and herself, they're very intimate paintings,
yeah.
And I said, is that tough to put them out in the world? Is it tough, like your mum saying no one's going to want those, but they do want those? You have a lot of people that really love your work, and you're being in great collections, and you've got like loyal collectors. Is there a reluctance on your part, or any like heartbreak of putting them out in the world and someone's got your mum on their wall?
Yeah, it's all like, I find it very difficult to part with those paintings. I actually kept quite a lot of them. It's both difficult to let go of them, but then also really special to think of other people like having them in their house. And so I think one of the things I was worried about when I was starting that body of work, that it might be too personal, and that, like, why would anybody really care about seeing pictures of my mum? And is it a bit sentimental to have these paintings, sort of thing? But a lot of people seem to respond to them, and they're like, "Oh, I look at that and I see my mum." You know,
yes,
like,
exactly.
And that was
the universality
such a,
of it. Yeah,
100%.
Really touched me that for other people felt like, yeah, that they saw their own mum in those pictures of
mine. That's what I was kind of getting at earlier. That's what I love about this collaboration and connection. Because even you as a voyeur, say, walking around London, and you get fleeting glimpses of, I don't know, a woman in a window, that's also an experience that people have in a city. It's kind of a very, it's an experience you don't acknowledge, like, as someone living in the city, until I see the painting. And then when you see the painting, it brings back memories of my own experience. It's really powerful, that.
But it's what the best art does, is it makes you see something and then you see it everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, we will now see your images everywhere we go, and you'll imagine these people in your images. And it makes you feel more, I see your images of your mum, and it makes me love my mum more.
Oof.
And go, oh, okay, well, you did that, and I give you all the love and respect in the world that you did do that when we were kids, and you still do that every day. That's what the best art does.
Yeah. On a really practical level, so you take photographs in these situations, whether it be your mum, whether it be the cleaners, whoever it is you're following. And is that just a kind of the easiest way of documenting it? Because you obviously can't sit down and actually do it, you know.
Is that a smartphone as well?
Just, and yeah, how are you documenting?
No, I use like a digital SLR. When I first started working with a model in interiors when I was at the Royal College, so quite a long time ago now, And at the time I was drawing and painting the model on location and doing things like that. And I carried on with that for a few years in combination with the photographs. But in the end, I felt like if I'm drawing and there's a figure, all I'm really interested in looking at is the figure. Mm. And actually what my work is really about is this relationship between the figure and the environment. And there's something about photography that is quite democratic in the way that it captures that. You know, like it's just taking everything in at the same intensity. And then, so that means that when I've got that material in the studio as well, I have that quite democratic kind of treatment of that situation to work with, which is something that I'm thinking about in the paintings. You know, it's the same level of care given to painting, a bin bag in the corner as it is given to the figure and the face. The photography is such an important tool for me. I might come away with like hundreds of photographs from a shoot, especially with these works that are about trying to document somebody while they're working, because I want it to be very natural, so I'm just sort of snapping away while they're doing whatever they're doing. And then it's back in the studio, it's then that I start to kind of translate that that reference material into something else, through lots of drawing and kind of quite crude collaging often. Actually, a collaging portion that's really just done through drawing.
So you'll bring like that body position from them and that bed angle, and you'll splice it in some ways.
Not always. Sometimes I have an image that's great and I can use it quite directly. But often, particularly if it's a multi-figure kind of composition. So for example, one of the big paintings that I made from the hospital is of an operating theatre junior C-section. It's got 9 people in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think I used like 5 or 6 different photographs.
Yes,
yeah. To sort of put it together. So there's quite a long process of kind of working out how to put things together in that way. I'm working out what the subject is, because there's a lot of photographic material, and that starts to, as the time sort of goes on and I'm just in the studio with this stuff, it mixes with that memory of having been there. So I think that's why it's always been really important for me that it's me that's there in that situation and having that relationship with that subject, whether that's a relationship that lasts 5 minutes, you know, a couple of hours or a lifetime sort of thing. It's kind of, it has to be something about how I felt being there when I was taking those photographs as well.
But that's inspired by your own pregnancy, right? This series of work came from you being in a maternity ward and witnessing everything that's going on around you.
In part. So I'd actually, I was already discussing doing a residency with the hospital before I got pregnant. The show that I did, which was at the Fitzrovia Chapel, we'd been talking about this for about 3.5 years before it actually happened. And Hannah Watson, the chair of the chapel, and I had put together this idea of doing something that might look at nursing and showing that in the chapel, because Fitzrovia Chapel is the former hospital chapel for Middlesex Hospital, which is no longer exists.
Which had the AIDS ward for London.
Yes, exactly, yeah. I'd started speaking to the hospital and they were interested, but I hadn't really figured out where I wanted to be in the hospital yet. And then I got pregnant and started going to UCLH myself, like in a personal capacity, and just started getting kind of interested in or getting a blood test, being like, that curtain's a nice colour of purple, or stuff like, what's she doing over there? Or like, you know,
would you whip your camera out, or would you be sketching point?
Just thinking, plotting,
right.
And I sort of suddenly kind of thought, hang on a minute, this is like the obvious place in the hospital for me to be, because could there be a more, you know, women-centred part of the hospital? Like, obviously, all the patients are women, but it's overwhelmingly the workforce is women as well, because midwifery and nursing are so heavily female dominated. So at some point during that, I just sort of thought, oh, I think this is where I want to be. But it wasn't until about a year and a half after my daughter was born, because of the pandemic, that I actually went to the hospital to start the residency.
This is an incredible show, because these were three huge paintings, theatre, as we just discussed, which is a C-section. You've got nine doctors, did you say?
Nine figures
around it. Then there's one called Ultrasound and one called Birthing Pool, and they were in the Fitzrovia Church. And they were inspired by four paintings, two diptychs, that were in the reception of the Middlesex Hospital, and they're now in the collection of the Wellcome Collection. But they were images of medical staff at work.
Yes, they were called the Acts of Mercy by Frederick Cayley Robinson, and they kind of encapsulate. They're sort of representational figurative paintings, but quite symbolist in a lot of respects, and they were about reflecting the original purpose of hospitals, which was much broader than our contemporary idea of hospitals. It wasn't just about giving medical care. They were often about feeding and
orphans.
So it was about sort of caring for the community in a much broader respect. So yeah, those paintings became a bit of a starting point in terms of the work that I was going to make. Not so much in terms of the actual content and sort of subject matter, but more thinking about the idea of the paintings in and about hospitals.
And the scale.
Yes, and the format, yeah. So I made the big paintings that I presented exactly the same size as those original Middlesex Hospital ones.
There's something about this story, knowing that the AIDS war was there and lots of wards, obviously, but the fact that so many people would have witnessed these paintings as they entered reception to go through whatever they were going through. And now in the Fitzrovia Chapel, you've created this body of work which is referencing that and then the now. It's phenomenal. What was that process like of making them paintings of that scale in? Is that the big issue you've worked at?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So each one was 2 metres by 3.40 metres. I make a lot of large-scale paintings, but this quite panoramic format of these ones was quite different for me. I'm not used to working on, it's almost a sort of cinematic kind of scale or something.
Yeah.
And I have quite a small studio, so...
I was going to ask about the studio. So yeah. Studio, they're big for the studio.
Oh, yeah, like my studio is like 5 by 7 metres. So it's like, by the time I got to the last one, I left the C-section one to last because it was really difficult. But by then I had these other two ones sort of piled up on the side on an already massive pile of painting. And as I couldn't really see what I was doing, and I'm getting very annoyed with them. So it was definitely it was a bit of a challenge. And it was when I saw them in the chapel for the first time, I was a bit like, oh, like, wow, that's what they look like, because I couldn't really get very far away from them.
Or you can't step back.
Yeah, not sort of properly, like to really get a sense of whether they work or not, because especially something like that theatre painting, as I said, it was a bit of a composite of quite a few different images. So I was trying to, which were at slightly different scale as well, so I was trying to piece together a room that spatially worked as well, sort of reconstructing these sort of moving things around a bit. And often it's a bit difficult to see if things like the perspective and things fully worked until you see something in a big space and you can step back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
You know, I think sometimes when you look at works like the kind of body of work that you're making, often people are so drawn to the figure. So they think about the story of that person, particularly if they find out their name and it becomes a kind of narrative. But what I find really interesting about your work is the psychological space, the actual interior space, the walls, even if you're viewing from outside through a window, the fact that they're contained in that space. Can you talk a bit about psychological space?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important part of how I think about placing those subjects in those compositionally in the paintings. I'm always thinking about, you know, what's meeting the edge of the canvas, where is the figure within that, and how that plays into this idea of that space as a metaphor for an interior space, or what it tells us about, or what we can imagine about how that person might be feeling in that position. Mm-hmm. And that's when I used to make those very constructed paintings, I always talked about it in this terms of sort of maison scene, like those elements that come together to make a story. Mm. So this place, people, lighting, objects, all these sort of things that start give you all these clues about somebody. When I was making that work, I was deciding on what all those things were. And now when I go to somewhere, I'm looking at what's there and thinking about what are the important things that tell me about that sort of psychological space. What's the lighting? How does that change how that space feels. So the hospital painting is quite a good example of that, actually, because the interiors of a hospital are quite uniform in a lot of ways, you know, in terms of interior design, I guess, you know, because the purpose of them is a clinical purpose.
It's functional, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there, and for a vast majority of the spaces, it's this quite sort of harsh, bright light. So the operating theatre painting is all about this bright light to be able to see what work they're doing. But the other two paintings, the ultrasound painting, it's this darkened room where the only light source is this image on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was making that painting, I was thinking about the space of that room being almost sort of womb-like in a way. It's sort of dark and sort of encircling these figures there. And then in the birthing pool painting, they've turned off all the electric lighting because they're trying to create this relaxing space for this woman who's in labour. And it's just this cool daylight coming through the window. So there's just that change in lighting transforms what those spaces become and their intention. So that's something that's always like a huge part of what I'm thinking about, how you set the things up, that and what that does to colour, you know, and how we read different colour and interpret that to mean a certain thing.
Yeah, I feel like in hospitals as well, they have so many smooth surfaces. So like even the floors, when you walk on them, you kind of, it's like no other space you go to really, because there's that kind of squeaking feeling.
Yeah.
And also cleanliness and like the hygiene and the way everything has to, you know, they're so worried obviously about MRSA and like, you know, different bacteria. So I'm always really hyper aware. I don't know if it's like an OCD thing, but when I go into a hospital, I'm always like, is everything clean? Is everything being cleaned? You know, it's like a real hypertension that kind of happens that is psychological as well. I realized through looking at your work how important there's a whole history of artists who have made work about very domestic scenes, but even contemporary artists like Lindsay Mendick, Tracy Emin, Louise Bourgeois, Kathy Wilkes, they're all kind of like heroes of mine and often thinking about psychological space. Can you speak a bit about some of your influences? Like, I know that you look very, very far back, maybe not so contemporary, and how those influences impacted, you know, your progress.
Yeah, I think the biggest influences on my work, I mean, I certainly look at lots of contemporary artists and I'm interested in what my peers and things are doing, but I think as I think might be the case for a lot of artists, sometimes it's easier to look at something that's quite historically distant from yourself to actually draw inspiration from for your own work, and for me that's, I mean, a couple of different sort of periods of painting, but the main one for me has really always been sort of late 19th century painting. A lot of French painters, Manet, Degas, Cassatt, Morisot.
These kind of Cassatt painted family members as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, so I've certainly looked at those a lot in the last few years. Same with Morisot, like a lot of paintings of women, mothers and children, or often, actually, I think is the case in some of those, it's more like nurses and the children, so the people that are actually doing the looking after the kids. So that kind of painting of modern life, I suppose, as it was sort of thought. And then the other big sort of area of interest for me has been Dutch genre painting. So again, is another sort of reflection of a particular time, a particular society, through depictions of the everyday.
This is the light, isn't it? This is Dutch light Vermeer. This is what I see with the computer screen, is the window in the kitchen.
Yeah,
you know, when
yeah.
they're playing cards or cross stitching, it's like embroidering. It's that light that you know, in the every day you notice it as a light in a ward, but then as soon as it becomes an artwork, then that light references art history.
Yeah,
and that's what it does in your practice. It's definitely Vermeer in there, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a huge influence for me. The light in these Dutch paintings, and also the way that they constructed space, these sort of successive spaces that you often look through. And that's quite a big part of the way I construct space myself. Rarely do something where you're looking at quite a simplistic space. There's nearly always something that you've got to look through or get past to view a subject. And then the other influence really for me is, as I said, you know, I spent a lot of time when I was growing up looking at Scottish painting. So Scottish colourists like Peplow, Ferguson, and also Glasgow Boys of the sort of 1880s. So Guthrie was a big sort of painter that I looked at a lot when I was...
And these are figurative works.
Yeah, yeah, very. And it's interesting, actually, that this connection between Scottish and French painting, because actually the Scottish painters of that time were looking to France rather than England. You know, like, I think there were more parallels in the way the actual paint handling. Like, so it's quite sort of... I'm going to try and find the word now... sort of buttery use of paint, you know, like the way that you might think about, like, a lot of impressionist sort of way that they're sort of moving paint around, and that's quite typical of the way a lot of Scottish painters were working at the time. So that's probably where a lot of these, I think, in the same way that you sort of talking about how a lot of artists, the thing that they were really drawn to as a kid is the thing they, and I think a lot of that still remains, like the paintings that I loved looking at when I was a teenager, you know, I still love.
I see Paula Rego weirdly as well at times.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely love Paula Rego. She's one of my heroes. I think she's amazing.
Yeah.
So the new exhibition that's about to open in April at Stephen Friedman Gallery in central London, that must be very exciting. Can you speak a bit about that specific project? Because this exhibition is very much focused on one individual.
Yes, my sister-in-law, Lisa. So this is a body of work that's kind of a partner, really, to what I was doing at the hospital. So if the hospital's looking at that clinical, professional angle of giving birth and of early motherhood, then Lisa is the more personal, subjective, at home kind of what happens next
kind of
view of that. So Lisa had her first baby at the beginning of August last year, which was it was actually the week before I went into the hospital to do this residency. So it was very much all happening at once, you know, kind
like
of...
Synchronized.
Yeah, seeing a sort of tiny little babies in the hospital and then going to visit them and getting a chance to have a shot. So the body of work, it spans about 4 months of time. So it's a month before the baby's born up until she's 3 months old. And it's really about that quite big transitional sort of moment, which is something I felt myself when I had my daughter. I was interested in trying to think about that through painting, because I know that, I mean, motherhood is something that obviously has been explored a lot as a subject, but I couldn't really see an awful lot of contemporary painting kind of explorations of that. In terms of what that looks like as a sort of everyday reality of, you know, the first month or two with a new baby can be quite claustrophobic in a way. They kind of feel like it's an endless day or night in a way, because everything is punctuated by this sort of feeding and
it's cyclical.
Sort of, yeah, exactly. So you kind of lose a bit of the sort of sense of days in the same way, and you're really tired and very sort of hormonal, and like the whole thing is
probably anxious.
Massively.
Like,
yeah.
What if you check on them all the time, and is this okay? And Google,
Doctor Google
must constantly be like, "What is this rash?"
Also, like physical recovery as well, and like healing and repair in a sense.
Yeah, it's a big shock to the system, I think, and it's. I think a lot of women feel like that, especially like with a first baby, because you don't really, everybody kind of tells you certain things, but you don't really know what to expect. So I thought it was an interesting subject, and it wasn't something, when I was going through it myself, I was like looking at all this kind of stuff that had suddenly appeared in my house that I never knew existed before, like breast pumps and sort of all manner of kind of like weird paraphernalia. And I was like, simultaneously feeling miserable, but then also thinking, that may be quite interesting in a painting. But I was thinking, I don't think I can make paintings about myself in this situation.
And you've never put yourself in a painting, have you?
Not in any kind of... Well, I not for a long time and not in any kind of really meaningful sort of way. Right.
So is that why you were reluctant to make yourself the subject?
Yeah, I think I did. I find it... I think there's a lot of me in all of the work that I make, but I'm interested in that in this slightly roundabout kind of way about thinking about things that are universal and that I can empathise with, but through looking at the lives of other people. And when Lisa, when I sort of found out she was pregnant and started to have this idea that maybe there was an opportunity to look at this as a subject through somebody that I'm very close to, and that it would also be, it would be different to the experience that I had as well, because she's actually done much better than I did, in that adjustment into this sort of different role. So
it's because you're there the whole time taking photos. It's like I'm not on my own with the baby. There's always someone there with the camera. I find.
So yeah, I don't know, I think I just sort of thought it was also like a really nice thing to document this moment for her in a way of this.
She was up for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. My brother was a bit like, "Hey, maybe you could get me in the background doing some woodwork or something outside in the workshop," and I was like, "No." It's always everybody else that gets to be in them. Like, it's Mum and now it's Lisa.
If you think about personal being political, and I know you're not in these paintings, but you've definitely like constructed them, thought about them, chosen the subjects deliberately. Can you speak a bit about the politics behind it, like the kind of drive behind this body of work? Because for me, I don't think it's just like a... It's very deliberate, isn't it, I think, in a sense?
Yeah, I think it's... Although these works... In a lot of ways, I'm always kind of like, oh, I'm just showing you what's here. I'm just documenting what other people are doing. You're right. There's a choice in what I choose to show, what the thing is that gets turned into the painting. And it is about giving sort of, I don't know, it's the things that I notice that I'm trying to show you as well, the things that are... all around us, but that maybe we don't stop and think to look at. Mm. And I think that is the sort of political bit in it. It's asking you not what to think about what I'm showing you, but just asking you to think about it, you know, like in whatever way that you respond to it. It's not about being descriptive in terms of... This is a painting about this sort of thing. It's saying these are these are everyday people's lives. You know, do you recognise something in that yourself? Like, is there something you can respond to?
I think there's a real dignity and kind of empathy and respect within these works, and that's what's so great about them. You know, is that connection you really, really have? It feels so focused and passionate on your part.
I think that's something about making paintings, I suppose, is spending all this time looking at somebody through that process of kind of getting to know the subject through making this work. I often find it weird when it's obviously different for subjects like Lisa or my mum, because it's almost harder sometimes. I've had such trouble painting Lisa's face because I know it really well.
Yeah. Right.
And because I know that she's going to see all the paintings, you know. And like,
has she seen them all yet? Or is the exhibition going to be the first time she sees them all together?
They're coming round next weekend to see everything kind of properly. But they saw some things in the studio a couple of months ago and obviously send her pictures and complain about her.
Her
face.
Your face is really annoying.
She's always like, oh, just make me better looking. I don't mind.
I mean, is there a vanity then when you're painting your mum and you're painting Lisa? These people, there's a responsibility to.
Well, you want to, I don't know if it's not about sort of flattering somebody, but it's about trying to show them in a way that they would feel was a truthful representation of that. Something that I want people to feel happy with how they've been represented. And that is always sort of a bit harder with the, yeah, with the people that I'm really close to. And often I used to, all the boyfriends I'd ever had, I often used to sort of make a painting of them at some point during the relationship. And as soon as I'd made the painting, that was it.
You dumped them?
Pretty much, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was the
concluding point. It was really weird.
Point,
my yeah. husband's the only one that's managed to survive.
Don't do a painting
of your husband.
Oh, you have done a painting of him?
Oh, you have?
He appeared in a painting as a, sort of, as a pool boy something. But I found it incredibly difficult to paint him.
You must have been scared when you started painting him.
Yeah,
like, it's a curse.
Well, we were already married by then, so I thought it might be a bit harder for me to sort of carry this one. But, yeah, with the people that I haven't, that I don't know so well, often it's weird when they do come to the studio and see the work, because I feel like I know them so well, because I've been like staring at these pictures of them and sort of like analysing them and think, going over and over again, this sort of feeling of like being with them in that quite short period. And then I realise that, you know, most of the relationship I've got with them is just between me and this painting. It's not really with them.
I also feel like we're just saying that you're not in the images as much now, but they are a self-portrait of you because they're told through the people that are closest to you in your life. So I guess in some ways it is a self-portrait.
Yeah, yeah.
Those series, yeah.
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 Can we talk about, before we get into our final questions, your painting process? You said you've got a tiny studio. Do you, and you're now going to move to the one in Scotland soon. Is that going to be
big? That's going to be really big, yeah.
Right. So are we going to see bigger works?
I was going to say, are we going to get huge paintings?
Mural size or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not that sort of tall myself. I already have to go up and down a ladder a lot. So I don't know if they're going to get that much bigger because they're already kind of at the big paintings I make are at the scale that you could walk into them.
Yes.
And they're already kind of a room, you know, the size of a room that they're describing. So I think if they were going to get bigger, it'd have to be describing a much bigger space.
When there's photographs of you stood in front of your paintings, it feels very theatrical, like you're on a movie set or a theatre set, because they are life-size, as you say. The figures end up being like you can walk into the scene and be part of that domestic space.
Yeah, I want it's the viewer to feel like they're in that room or they're kind of, they're implicated in that action in some way.
Mm. I've represented a few artists who say that they make paintings and when they make them bigger, they always do them in parts, you know, in like a smaller canvas that joins onto another canvas.
Oh, okay.
Because they like the actual way they can pick up the canvas themselves, rather than if you had like a 4 meter canvas that is that size. There's two artists I worked with, John Key's one of them, I think, but they loved this idea anyway of like a physicality, like the way that they actually, their own body is in relation to the canvas and that they're sort of able to control it, move it around the studio and actually have that part of it somehow.
Yeah, unfortunately mine are they're too big for
you to be able to carry. Yeah.
I mean, I can move them around, but I can't get them up on the wall by myself or sort of move them up and down.
Do you have people in the studio then, assistants now?
No, my husband's office is like 5 minutes walk away, so I'm just like phoning him, I'm like, at lunchtime, can you come and help me move this painting?
Pop by the bakery.
Yeah. You get the sandwiches from Rabs,
exactly.
And then you've got to come and move this painting with me.
Do you always work from a sketch, a study? And also the studies are part of your output that people can see. I don't think we've ever really seen the photographs, the original subjects, but we're seeing the studies and then the finished paintings.
Yeah, yeah. So I make these oil sketches, kind of small studies for all of the big paintings, which is kind of where I'm starting to translate that photographic language into paint. And then they're what I'm using as a basis to work from for the big paintings. I show them alongside the paintings. Although they're part of the process, I do also see them as works in their own right.
And do they ever just survive as an oil study that never becomes a painting?
Yeah, got a number of. Often there's quite a few that I might have a couple of ideas for something that's quite similar. And it's not until I do the sketch that I can actually see what's going to work on the big scale. Because things that work on a large scale are often quite different to the things that I'll consider for something small.
Right.
It has to be a sort of complex enough space. It has to have quite a lot of different details and things going on in it to warrant making it that sort of larger size and to have enough interest in terms of like actually painting it.
And that must just be an instinct you get when you see the image.
Yeah, yeah, usually.
How many paintings do you work on at once?
Just one at a time. Mainly because I've only got one painting wall.
That change again then, the next space?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. But each painting's got a very specific palette. So it's... I tend to sort of... It's like quite self-contained with that sort of... the colours that I'm mixing up for that particular work. Sometimes I'll, if I'm at the end stages with a big painting and I'm not, I need to leave it for a couple of days and sort of come back and start adjusting things, I'll start the underpainting for a next painting. Right. But that's something I do in acrylic, so it's a slightly different kind of thing. So I'm never really working on two oil paintings at once.
So acrylic underpainting always, and then the paint you use is oil.
Yeah.
Do you have a certain brand that you're loyal to?
I'll use a lot of Michael Harding oil paints. Also quite a lot of Winsor Newton artists' colours, and Old Holland. That's the three kind of.
And what is it about oil you like most?
It's just really luscious, isn't it? I think I find it a really seductive medium to move around, and it can be really juicy. all my paintings are done kind of wet and wet, which is why the acrylic underpainting is quite useful for me, because that creates a structure. And that means when I go into oil painting, I'm really just able to enjoy that surface. And if I'm doing a big painting, I'm kind of sort of working around it. I usually start at whatever's furthest away spatially and kind of work towards the front of the image.
Oh, right. So you might start with a figure first, because that's furthest away sometimes.
Yeah. So there's a painting that's in the Lisa show that is sort of in my mind because I was working on it a couple of weeks ago when Peter, my photographer that shoots all my work, he came and took a portrait of me, and he was like, "I want you in front of this painting. Like, tell me when you're
working on it." Oh, I've seen that portrait.
Yes,
it's a really beautiful portrait.
Yeah,
I've seen it. Caron sent it to us yesterday.
Stephen Friedman.
Lisa's in the kitchen.
We've got strict instructions not to share any of the image of you were sent until later. But it's a beautiful portrait.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. You feel like you're part of the theatre set. You are actually.
Yeah, that's what he. I sort of showed him all the oil sketches for the paintings I was making, and he's like, "This is the one I want." So he wanted me to look like I was sort of standing at the bottom of these stairs.
Yes.
But when I was making that painting, it's at a start. The first thing I did was this. You can see the garden out of the kitchen window at the back. So it's like I do that, and then I kind of do the kitchen cabinets and the washing machine, and then Lisa goes in on the floor, and you know, so quite the last thing to go in is the front of the knob on the bottom of the stairs. Sort of
thing.
So it's like, there's this like physical kind of construction of the space, I suppose.
Are there anything that you, and you saying Lisa's face frustrated you, are there any things that you hate painting? Some artists hate hands and feet and they disguise them as much as possible. Are there things you're like, oh God, I've got to paint a bloody
chair. This is gossip,
chair,
I love it.
Or I've got to paint a remote control or a TV. Are there things that you're like, ah?
There was some really boring stuff in the hospital paintings. The painting of theatre, spent a whole day painting this beige area of the painting. That's this it's a thing called a resuscitator. It's the bit that they put a baby on when they've just been born, and it's a sort of heated kind of thing.
Mat. Is it like a changing mat?
It's sort of like that, and it's got a little hood bit that comes over the top of it, and it's got lights and things on it. But anyway, it's like the most boring thing to paint in the world. And I was like, oh, this is like, when is this gonna be finished? So there's often like things like that, like really banal, kind of dull equipment that is not interesting in any way, but it's totally necessary to activate the bits that are really nice to paint. Mm-hmm. So in that painting, it was like, right, I'll get that bit out of the way, and then tomorrow I can paint all the nice sort of theatre gowns and things like that, you know, like the bit, the drapery, the bits that
give yourself
sort of
a reward.
Yeah, yeah, you have to give yourself a reward to do, for wow. doing really boring bits.
Well, you were mentioning Louise Giovanelli, who is with Grimm Gallery as well,
yes.
who represents yep. in the States, and she paints a lot of curtain paintings, and they are literally just like draped curtains, huge scale, but she takes absolute, obviously, pleasure in
yeah.
creating these paintings. Whereas
and you can see that, I
you
think.
You can absolutely
paintings.
See that. Whereas yeah. I feel like that element of your work would be the bit that you would be like, get this out of the way so I can get to the...
Well, the curtain would be all right.
Oh, really?
It's the flat walls. Yeah, oh, they're really... right. Sometimes I feel like I'm actually painting
your
walls.
Wall.
Yeah.
Because they're so big, you're doing like house
yeah,
renovations.
Yeah, yeah, basically got like a sort of 4-inch brunch.
Well, some of the paintings of Lisa, they are renovations. It's like a plaster wall at one point, yeah. isn't there?
Yeah, much to my brother's annoyance. He's like, what did you paint that in for? And I'm like, what's what it looks like? It's a sort of, there's a bit in that painting yeah. with the plaster wall.
Polyfiller
sort of,
and stuff.
Yeah, and there's like a patch on the kitchen ceiling, which is where he fell through the ceiling when he was doing some plumbing work in the bathroom.
He wants you to do like a changing rooms, like renovation in the painting
yeah.
of
you know,
the house.
People are going to be, you know, they're going to see that as coding. In about 400 years, people are going to be looking at that painting going like, this area of the ceiling obviously signifies like an yeah. emotional journey. It's going, no, it's my brother fell through the ceiling.
Yeah.
They won't realise.
It was an emotional journey for Lisa. It took him 6 months to do the bathroom. So yeah,
oh, wow. Why is it always, you know what it makes me think of though? Because it coincides with so much of a newborn baby and friends having kids. They do their house at the same time.
Yeah.
Which always
yeah. And
like,
it never gets, it's never done in time.
No,
stuff.
So suddenly you've got all this like paraphernalia of renovating a house alongside a newborn baby.
I know, home yeah. renovation's like stressful enough.
Yeah,
like
they always seem to coincide because you're always yeah. trying to get the nursery ready for the baby, and then it just
yeah.
goes, well, let's do this as well, and yeah. then suddenly it's too late and you're in it.
Yeah, yeah, it's funny because the house, their house now doesn't even look like that. That the kitchen, the sort of country kitchen that's in there, that's quite hideous, and they've now ripped it out, and he's in the process of putting a new kitchen in, so it's a real snapshot again of like a particular moment in their life as a family in that house as well.
It's incredible, but like our projections onto it is that I recognise that scene. I know I've been in that house. I've been with friends who are
totally,
experiencing
totally.
That, and that's what your work is. It's universal, and it's the everyman or the everywoman. So the final questions we come to, the first one is, if you could do an art heist, I don't know if you're a collector of art yourself or if you trade with artists, but what work of art would you have for yourself and why?
If I could have anything in the world ever, I would have Manet's A Bar at the Folies Bergère. It's my favourite painting ever.
And actually, didn't Griselda Pollock wrote a really amazing article about your work or a piece of writing
wrote,
about
yeah,
your work?
Yeah, she wrote an essay.
And she included that in it, didn't she?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sort of, that was such an amazing moment for me, having Griselda
Incredible,
write about
yeah.
my work, because she's somebody whose writing I've been reading,
yeah.
you know, since I was a student. And yeah, and for her to talk about my work in the context of a painting like that, as having a conversation with that kind of work is, yeah, really special for me. But that painting, I could never tire of looking at it.
Where is it? Have you seen it in the flesh, obviously?
Yeah, many times. It's at the Courtauld.
It's in London, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the barmaid that's looking out at you, but then the sight line, the reflection of the barmaid doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's
right. You won't
right.
be able to see it
yeah.
in that reflection.
It's
yeah.
sort of, it's kind of everything for me, and it's the possibility of what a painting can do, but still within this realms of being naturalistic
yeah.
in its, what it's presenting, you know, its reality, but it's there's something a little bit, there's a mystery about it, and that look on her face is really inscrutable. You don't,
yeah,
you
again,
kind of,
it's like, what do you want? Or
yeah,
what
yeah.
are you after? But I guess, like, what Manet has done, which is what your work is doing, is he's giving her agency and made her exist. I guess she would have been, would that have been an invisible job? I guess not. Barmaids are quite a focal.
Yeah, and like I suppose it was, she probably would have been the subject of quite a lot of unwanted attention, I imagine, as
yeah,
well in a
yeah.
place like the Folies Bergère. But
yeah.
I mean, I think that the painting was a sort of a construction in his studio with that model, with somebody that he worked with a number of times over his career.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think it's, I mean, it's a beautiful painting, but it's also just such a window into a another time.
Yeah, it's history.
Yeah.
It's there.
It's funny, those paintings, because they're so familiar to everybody. They're kind of in our consciousness, in a sense, like if you've been exposed to art, I guess. But I think people that have been, it's kind of a painting that everyone thinks they know. But when you actually go and see it, it's such a different thing, isn't it? These iconic works are actually iconic
it's
for a reason.
The scale, because you just see them reproduced in books.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't really get a grip of it. And then when you see it in the flesh, you're like, that is tiny. Like the Mona Lisa, for example, is like, everyone goes and sees that and they're like, it's tiny. Mm. And then you see Guernica and you're like, it's huge. But you only see it in books. Another question, quickly, to go back though. Is the conceit of the Peeping Tom ever something you've considered?
What do you mean by that?
Well, like, because the Peeping Tom thing is the voyeuristic approach, is someone kind of in the tree watching a woman and them not realising they're being watched. The Peeping Tom, and it's something that I was like, what the hell is the Peeping Tom? And then I went back, I've got like the history over here, which I can reveal. But that kind of concept of being watched without realising you're being watched.
Yeah. I suppose Peeping Tom, though, I think suggests a sexualized gaze, doesn't it?
Yeah, or a threat as well.
Yeah, and I think what I'm interested in, that viewpoint of somebody that's not aware of being watched, is that they're not performing to anybody either. You know, that they're absorbed in the thing that they're doing, and their unawareness of being looked at means that they might be, you might see something different than if they're
in an unguarded moment.
I think it's a daydreaming element as well, because the ones where you're looking through a window, like there's this sense that like they've got all their thoughts going on, whereas if you said to them, can I do a portrait of you, they're going to look at you, aren't they? It's a bit like if you do a photograph of someone when they're not aware.
Yeah, posed.
Sometimes you get the most beautiful portraits.
Yeah, let me just Peeping Tom, for people that are worried about that, are so basically hundreds of years ago, Lady Godiva was good news and all the peasants were being taxed a lot, and she said to her husband, if I can go through the town naked on a horse and none of the peasants look at me, then will you stop taxing the poor so much? And he said, yeah, it's impossible, you're never gonna be able to do it, you're a beautiful woman, you're never gonna be able to go through a town naked on horseback. But she did go through naked on horseback through the town, and all the peasants looked away. They said, we're not going to observe her. But Tom the tailor broke the trust and spied on her. So that's where the term Peeping Tom comes from.
Oh,
yes. So he kind of ruined it for everyone.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I never heard that before.
Yeah.
The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
I knew you were going to ask this. It's a difficult question.
I know it isn't.
As a painter, I've got two answers. I'm allowed two answers.
You're allowed anything you want.
There's a colour that I couldn't do without on my palette, which is ultramarine violet. And I use it in everything. Every single painting has always got this violet in it.
Has it?
Yeah, even though like it's not very visible, I use it as a sort of mixing kind of thing to, especially when I'm doing things like beige hospital equipment, like it's got quite a lot of ultramarine violet mixed into it. But then there's colours that I'm really excited about squeezing out to use. Number one would probably be King's Blue, which is a pale kind of bluey purple colour. And it's something that I use a bit when I'm often, some of these more voyeuristic paintings of mine looking into windows are at twilight. So that kind of purpley blue kind of light that might be on the outside of the building looking into the warm interior, that's often got a lot of this King's Blue in it. And then the other favourite is this one called, Oxide of Chromium? Or it's a sort of, it's this green and it stinks, but I love the smell of it.
What?
I don't know, something like really toxic. It must be, maybe it's this chromium, so like, you know, it smells of metal. It's sort of one of those, like, I'm sure it's like really bad for me even just sort of sniffing it.
But yeah.
And it's this really dense kind of quite grey and greeny grey colour. So I'm always quite pleased if I get a chance to use it, because it's not a colour that sort of crops up that often.
I guess PPE blue must appear a lot recently with
Oh,
kind of
yeah,
maternity
yeah, that's
ward.
Cerulean blue got through sort of tubes and tubes of that.
A lot of artists who were kind of channeling work at the PP Blue during the pandemic must have been going through tubes.
Yeah, sales of Cerulean Blue.
Yes. Now they're probably going, no, we need another lockdown to make a sale in of all these paints we've got. Yeah.
Who was the other artist that did that amazing series that Oliver Hemsley loves? Is it Barbara Hepworth?
Yeah,
who did the Nurses.
Oh, Nurse series.
The Nurses series. Are you aware of those ones?
Oh, yeah, they're fantastic. Sort of drawings of surgeons, I think, a lot of them. And they have amazing focus on the hands working together in this quite collaborative ways. Yeah, they're incredible pieces.
And wearing face masks, aren't they? And
yes, exactly. Yeah, I remember Oliver telling us about them.
Yeah. Before. What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
When I was in my last year of my BA at Glasgow, it's in 2003, 2004, I kind of lost my way a little bit for a couple of years at art school, kind of trying to find myself artistically. And I got to the stage where I was making paintings of figures, but they were just sort of floating around in kind of nothing. And one of my tutors, a really great painter called Moina Flanagan, who is also one of the artists that shows with Ingleby Gallery, who I also work with, she said to me, she was like, "What are these figures doing? Just put them somewhere." And that was the best. It seems really obvious, but it was a bit like, oh yeah, I should put them somewhere. And that's kind of all I've been doing since then.
Putting
figures somewhere and thinking about where they are.
Practical, direct, but super useful.
Yeah, and that kind of, that was really then the start of the work that I'm still making now, like putting figures in interiors.
Brilliant.
Amazing. Thank you very much. Your show is coming up at Stephen Friedman Gallery from the 28th of April to the 28th of May, called Lisa. What else can we see?
I have a show on at the moment at Nottingham Castle, which is a sort of double solo show. It's me and Laura Knight, which I'm quite excited about because it's another artist whose work I really admire, and who made a lot of paintings of women at work, which was why our works have been put together in this context.
When was she working? Is she still working?
No, she was active mainly in the first half of the 20th century.
Right.
She died in 1970.
Okay.
Some of her most famous work, she was a World War II official sort of artist, and she made a lot of paintings of women working in munitions factories and doing, you know, stepping into these quite male-dominated spaces. And she also made some beautiful paintings of women ballet dancers behind the scenes, you
like
know,
Degas.
In their dressing rooms and things. Yeah, like Degas, but I think with a slightly different viewpoint, probably because of her position as a woman artist, she kind of afforded a slightly different access to these women and in this quite private space of a dressing room. So
it reminds me of an incredible thing. I interviewed an artist the other day about when the war was happening and men were at war, the women were at home, and their lingerie and underwear changed because it wasn't to appeal for the male gaze, because so much of the lingerie was designed to please the man instead of being like comfortable for the women. And they were in these really comfortable lingerie, and they said that when the war finished, a lot of women complained because suddenly they had to wear, everything was kind of tightened up and neater, and everything was kind of less comfortable for them, but just to appease the man.
Yeah.
And it really made me just consider all these kind of situations that come that women have been subjected to because of the male gaze, because of the male need.
Yeah, that takes something like a war to actually shift something a bit. Yeah. Into...
But then it went back after the war. Then it was like they had this period of history where they were comfortable.
Yeah,
and suddenly after the war, it's like, okay, now you get...
Yeah, but also there's been a whole development, if you think of like Agent Provocateur, and even in recent times, like of underwear, where it's women choosing the underwear to empower themselves. So it's no longer, you know what I mean? It's about feeling sexy, and that's valid too.
Yeah.
It's all possible.
Yeah,
it's not all just about what a man wants. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this has been incredible. So Nottingham Castle, then Stephen Friedman Gallery, and then lots, because you are very successful and you're getting lots of attention. And how is that? Do you just have to shut the noise out, or?
Yeah, you just, you know, it doesn't matter how much exciting stuff's going on. And if you can't paint Lisa's face when you're in the studio, it's just as annoying as ever. So, when I'm in the studio, just... You're just focused on what you're making and trying to make that work and the things that you're trying to achieve. So it's quite easy to separate all that stuff out, I think.
It sounds like Scotland's going to be a wonderful adventure for you, and I'm really glad that you're able to make space for your creativity to protect that. It's really exciting. So you can visit at Stephen Friedman Gallery on Instagram to find out more about the exhibition that opens at the end of April on the 29th. You're also represented by Grimm in New York and Amsterdam and Ingleby Gallery in Edinburgh. Yeah, you can go to all their Instagrams. We'll be sharing and linking to everybody. Are you on Instagram?
I am, yep.
What's your handle?
At Caroline Walker Artist.
Cool, very direct, love that. So you can follow Caroline's work there and also send her messages of love and admiration and respect because we love you very much. Your paintings are extraordinary, yeah. And it's been such a great privilege. And I can't tell you the amount of artists who heard we were doing this episode and like screamed when they heard. They were literally like, you're meeting Caroline Walker? I love her work. Like people are really into your work, other artists. It's really wonderful
that's so nice to
see. Yeah. So thank you so much for everything.
Thanks very
really
much.
Generous interview, thank you.
All right, we'll see you all soon, everyone.
We'll be back very soon. Bye, Caroline. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.